again and welcome to Off the Deaton Path. My name is Stan Deaton with the Georgia Historical Society, and we welcome you to our podcast for January 22nd, 2018. The music you just heard there was very appropriate for today's show. Astute listeners will recognize it as the theme to the TV show Homicide, Life on the Street, which was absolutely one of my favorite shows in the 1990s. We have a very special program today. This is the first of a two-part show we're doing, an interview with a real-life homicide detective, Sergeant Hiram Pete Rivera Jr. with the Savannah-Chatham Metropolitan Police Force. Specifically, he is with the Criminal Investigation Division, the Homicide Unit. This is a wide-ranging interview that I conducted with Sergeant Rivera in the lobby of the Marshall House Hotel in Savannah. I hope that you enjoy it. As you listen, you will hear background noise from time to time, but I hope that you will be able to hear Sergeant Rivera and all that he has to say about what homicide detectives do, what we think that they do, what they really do, and a lot of stuff that we have no idea that they do. This was recorded on December 14th, 2017. We're going to split this into two parts this week. Here is part one. Sergeant Rivera, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. Appreciate it.
You are a homicide detective.
Yes, sir.
Above and everything else that you do. I know that you're a father and you wear many hats, literally. I want to talk to you today about what homicide detectives do, what the public thinks that they do, what we have gathered from watching television programs that we think homicide detectives do.
Okay.
But let's begin, first of all, with telling me how long have you been on the job, not just here in Savannah, but anywhere else?
I started my career in law enforcement here in Savannah. I joined the Savannah Police Department in 2001. I went to the academy at Armstrong when the regional academy was there, and I started my career on patrol in Precinct 4 in the Southside Precinct. I did that for about 7 years, patrol work, various patrol work, crime suppression unit, things like that. And in about 2007, I had an opportunity to transfer up to the homicide unit. During my first 7 years here, when I became a police officer, it was because I wanted to make a difference in the community. I mean, of course, there's the excitement of being a cop, just the day-to-day unknowns that you're responding to. But the idea was I wanted to do something meaningful and something that had a positive impact, on victims and communities as a whole. And burglaries, property crimes, accidents, all of those things, they were important. But when I got my first taste of working a homicide, all of that paled in comparison to that first case. The excitement of the hunt, the intrigue of the puzzles and putting pieces together, and of course the desire to go after the confession when you know who you're trying to get. All of that is an experience that's unlike any other in the police department.
So you've been at this 10 years. As a homicide detective?
I've been in the homicide unit as a detective for 5 years. I am now back in a second tour as a supervisor.
Okay. And you supervise how many people?
We have a total of 8 homicide detectives. The unit is split in half into two teams of 4. I have another sergeant that works with me, Sergeant Santoro, and we both supervise the investigations and the detectives that are handling the investigations.
Now, I should tell our listeners that one of the reasons that I wanted to talk with you, I'm a huge fan of the television show Homicide, Life on the Street, which was on TV in the 1990s. It was revolutionary in its time, in part because of the way it was produced and the way it was shot. But it was really gritty, what we would now almost call reality TV. It seemed as if they had just taken a camera out into the streets of Baltimore and shot homicide detectives. Clearly, they were actors and very good at it, too. But it really, for the first time, kind of changed the way the viewing public looked at homicide detectives. There was nothing really romantic about what these guys did, in the sense that, not just romantic as in like a love life, but nothing glamorous about what they did. It was written by David Simon. He wrote a book called Homicide, A Year on the Killing Streets, and he himself was a homicide detective. And one of the things he said he wanted to do was sort of strip the glamour off of it. But there's nothing glamorous about standing over a dead body and then trying to figure out who did it. Would you agree with that? It becomes part of your life, just something that happens every day.
That is an accurate assessment. I mean, from the outside looking in, it could seem like it could be a pretty exciting life. And for the most part, it is definitely fast paced. It has its moments of excitement, but there definitely isn't anything glamorous. If you could tag along with a detective from the point they get called out in the middle of the night out of dead sleep to a scene, they've got to shake off the cobwebs. They got to get focused. They got to figure out what we have on scene, and then we've got to formulate a quick plan as to how we're going to approach every aspect of the investigation, everything from evidence collection to who do we talk to first, who's most important, who's least important, who's going to provide the most valuable information right now, and versus who might muddy the waters and send you off on some you know, random side road that's irrelevant to the investigation.
How do you figure out who to talk to first?
It could be a variety of different things. It could be something that the patrol officer provides initially on scene as to witnesses and people that are available right then and there. So on the immediate response, you want to deal with anyone that was at the scene and try to get a good interview from them. But the next step is to develop, if you don't have a direction as far as a suspect from just witnesses on scene, the next step is to develop a victimology, a background of the person who's died. Who their family are, you know, who where they work, who they associate with, what their habits are, where they hang out at night, where their normal routines are, any girlfriends or boyfriends, any fights, any enemies, any children. You'd be surprised. You'd be surprised the amount of information you can get from folks who seem to have, or they think they have, very little to offer. And when you get these patterns of behaviors from a variety of different people who are close to a victim, it's easy to go back and develop a timeline on where they were at, who they were with, and where they were last seen. And it helps us narrow down a direction. So imagine all of that going on at 3, 4 in the morning, you know, in the middle of the night. These guys come out, and that's if it's a fresh homicide. These guys have to go to autopsies. They have to watch medical examiners dissect a person and give you some scientific, you know, evaluations of injuries, pattern injuries, historical data as far as maybe illnesses that they may have had, anything that may have contributed to their death. It is definitely not glamorous. That would be probably the least descriptive word I would use for the job. It can be somewhat addicting. The intrigue of the cases, the desire to solve it, to figure it out. If you like putting together puzzles, you'd be a great homicide detective, because that whole itch to figure out why it happened, what happened, how it happened, when it happened, where it happened, and who did it, that is the driving force. And that's the qualities that we look for in a good homicide investigator, that innate desire to just stay after it. I shouldn't have to continually push an investigator to go after something. On occasion, I should have to slow them down and say, think about things for just a minute. Are you sure this is the right step? Are you sure we're on the right person? Are you sure we're processing something in the best possible manner to yield the best evidence or results? All of those things are things that you have to consider. And sometimes you take a step and you realize it's the wrong one. And there ain't no going back and going a different direction. You got to adjust sometimes and move forward.
Do you ever tell people, hey, you're on the wrong track, and they just keep going down it? They get focused on something,
so,
and you have to pull them back?
That's interesting you say that. So as a homicide sergeant, one of the things that I try to do is make sure that our investigators are following the evidence. Homicide detectives don't go out. We don't try to solve every case and arrest somebody in every case. That's what we hope for the outcome to be. But the idea is, for us, is we are truth seekers. So we are there to uncover the truth about what happened and let the chips fall where they may. Homicide itself is not necessarily a crime. There is some very legitimate homicides that occur. And it's our jobs as homicide detectives to identify all of the variables involved, try to excrete the truth out of anyone involved, the objective truth and not the subjective truth. And sift through all of that so we can put together a clear picture of what happened, how it happened, and who's responsible. And once we put that together, if there is some responsibility and culpability on the part of the person who committed the homicide, then the district attorney's office will give us a green light, and we'll make the charge, and we'll go forward with the case. On occasion, I have to remind a detective, we're not here just to go after somebody and lock them up. Make sure we're looking at the evidence. Make sure that we're objectively reviewing what they've said, their alibis, you know, making sure we're crossing every T, dotting every I. If we don't have to make an arrest right now and we can continue to work a case, we will do so until the last possible moment, just because we want to make sure we prove a case beyond a reasonable doubt. But on occasion, it's more beneficial for us to put a person in jail off of probable cause and work a case afterward. It really kind of depends on the case. But keeping detectives focused on the facts of the case and not focused on a suspect is important.
So what I hear is that the homicide detectives are the elite of the police. Is that true? Do you agree with that? And if that is true, why is it true?
I would like to think that we in our homicide office have the best investigators in the police department for several reasons. They are quick, responsive. They are competent. They are capable. They are efficient. They work well in a team. When I call out my team of detectives, one's at the scene, some are at the hospital, some are at the office typing a search warrant. None of those things can happen unless information is flowing back and forth. I was mentioning earlier, the first 48 is so crucial in an investigation for detectives to be able to work well together, trust each other, to know what information the other person needs in order to complete that portion of the investigation. It's all happening at the same time. So everyone has to be on their toes, have to be engaged, have to be willing to do their part in order for things to flow smoothly. So in the respect of being elite and being the best, we have folks that can come out and do cell phone extractions. We got people that can we can do exigent circumstance requests and try to ping phones and ping things when we have a missing person or a kidnapped individual or something along those lines. I think the investigators in my office are the most competent as far as search warrant preparation, putting together the right probable cause for arrest warrants, for search warrants, for anything else that needs to be executed. On any given homicide, our detectives are doing anywhere from 5 to 15 search warrants. You figure a house, a car, every cell phone that's involved, we search. Every social media site now, because a lot of that is important now, we're searching. And all of that requires search warrants. So our detectives are very, very good at a computer hammering out search warrants, putting together their information so that they can acquire access to additional potential evidence that may be available. And our detectives do that very efficiently, and they're also good at figuring out where we need to go next. And again, as a group, that's crucial. You definitely want to get more than one perspective when you're trying to tackle a case as complex as a homicide, because what I think and what I see in the case might be very different from the perspective that you're looking at it, and very different from the perspective you may be looking at. So it's very different, and for everyone to be able to trust each other and to be able to share your perspective, it's important to have that environment where you respect each other enough and that you are competent enough that you can say what you need to say, put it out on the table, and if somebody doesn't think that you have the right opinion or the right angle on it, we talk about why, and then we bring up everything else and go back and forth. So every case has a lead investigator, but our guys work as a team. You don't get that in many other departments. As a matter of fact, there isn't a criminal investigation division that works as a group better than a homicide unit, I think. You may have some tactical units that on the street that physically have to be prepared, SWAT guys and things like that, and they go out and they got to prepare in repetition. Well, our guys, it's a mental game. So to be able to work as a team from a mental perspective, I think that's where our guys rise to the top.
Do you ever have to use a firearm?
I hope I never have to use a firearm.
It sounds like it's absolutely not part of anything.
I hope I never have to use a firearm, honestly, on my job. The best weapon I have is my two lips right here and the words that are coming out of my mouth and the way I say them. And I learned that early on in my career, which is one of the reasons why I enjoy homicide work. I like the excitement of the job and the random critical incident that's happening and things like that. But for me, the most useful tool that any officer has is the head and the shoulders and the words that they're formulating, the phrasing of the words that they're formulating, because that right there is either going to get you the information you need or it's going to shut them down. And it doesn't matter how strong you are, how many search warrants you write, how much evidence you collect. If you can't get someone to talk to you and tell you about the reasons why something happened, you're never really going to get the full picture. All the evidence in the world can tell you what happened, but why it happened requires dialogue. It requires someone to come out and tell you why something transpired. And you got to have a gift for that. So in our unit, we have some folks that are better at it than others. There's some folks that are much more concrete, evidence-related type stuff. They can focus on those pieces and putting it together. We got some folks we can put in an interview room and they can talk for 6, 7, 8, 10 hours and really build a relationship with that person that they're talking to so that person feels comfortable. Anyone involved in a critical incident like a homicide, most people, I will say, they want to get it off their chest. You just got to figure out how to get it out of them. Most folks do. Being a witness or being involved in a traumatic incident like anything else, it's hard to keep inside. So being able to put the right detective in the room with them that gives them, that makes them feel comfortable expressing all of what happened and everything is important. If you put the wrong person in the interview room, it can mess up the entire case. And the moment you shut somebody down or someone shuts down on their own, you're done. The moment they lawyer up, a lot of times you're done. And a lot of times the lawyering up is based on how you've interacted with them in that few moments you've questioned them.
Which you always have to tell them they have the right to do that, right?
There are very specific instances.
Here's where it comes in. Okay.
So yeah. You have to be in custody, all right, and under interrogation. So
if you're just being brought in for questioning.
Yes, if you're just being brought in for questioning, I don't know, have to read you your rights. But if you say something when I'm talking to you that incriminates you, I have to stop at that moment and I have to read you your rights at that particular moment. Because if I know in the back of my mind, after you said what you just said, that I'm not letting you go home, I got to read you your rights. You've got to know that you're not going home right now. Mm-hmm. You know, but we can keep talking. Because it's important to know exactly what happened. And I'm going to do everything I can to flesh out the facts, you know, that you're telling me. And, you know, there's two sides to every story. And although you're going to be locked up tonight, you know, you tell me exactly what happened and I'll document it and I'll make sure that I get the other side of the story, you know. And it doesn't mean that you're guilty of the crime we're charging you with. It just means that right now you've said a few things that I've got to hold you responsible for. And we'll go from there. Doesn't make you a bad person, you know.
You're good at this.
And I would tell you that's what it is. Yeah. Because good people make mistakes every day. Sometimes it's life-changing and life-altering mistakes, but they're just mistakes. Rarely do you get into a box, like you had talked about earlier. Rarely do you get into a box with a hardened criminal, with that serial killer, or with that somebody that is so calculated and so cold that you're looking at them and they're playing that same game with you. That's an exception.
Have you ever had anybody get inside your head?
I've had folks try. Yes, I've had folks try. You know, there are... here in Chatham County, we find that most of the crime is committed by a small percentage of the community that are recidivists, and they're repeat offenders. So what you find are the ones that challenge you most in the interview room are those repeat offenders. They know the game. They know when their rights should have been read to them. They know when they need a lawyer. They know if they say something, you're going to, you know, jam them up. They know if this is their third strike and it's a felony that they're going back to prison for a long time. They know that if they tell on their friend that they're going to have to come to court and testify later because they know the system and they know the game. So those folks will tend to get into an interview room, intentionally shut down on you, ask you questions, you know, when you're asking them questions, trying to figure out what you know. We've even had people to the point that are so intelligent as far as the law that they know how much they can say. And they'll get to that particular point and they'll go, you know what, I think I need to talk to an attorney right now because I don't want to tell you about that part. I'll tell you about this part, but before I tell you about that, I need my attorney present. And, you know, if that happens, then it happens. You know, we get what we can and we try to move forward with it. Does it frustrate us? Oh, yeah. Do we let it show? Nope. Not one bit. It's just the investigation and the interview is just one piece of the bigger puzzle. So if we can end that note on you know, we'll leave it from here. Maybe we can come back later on and revisit this interview, and we can do that. Again, if it benefits the investigation to press the person, then we'll continue to try to push the individual at the time.
So let me ask you this question. So, I mean, this is a thinking man's game, as you said, or woman's, obviously. Do you ever have people who get into the unit and you realize, you know what, this guy, this woman's not that smart, not going to make it, or they just wash out for whatever reason?
Yes. There's a couple of different ways in which that could happen to an investigator. So one thing that a lot of detectives don't realize, again, the glamour part of the job, you know, you watch television and you see the investigators going out there, going after bad guys, you know, executing search warrants, standing over bodies, trying to figure out what's going on. What they don't show on television are all the hours that go into in front of a computer, all the typing that needs to be done, all of the report writing that needs to be done. That takes hours. And the thing that will run a detective off quicker than anything else is to get behind on several cases, not have turned in your reports, not have, because like we had said earlier about cold cases, we're constantly moving forward with the next homicide investigation. If you're not typing as you go, if you're not keeping track of all your evidence and your reports and all the things people have told you, all the recordings and all the things that you take with you on a homicide investigation, if you're not keeping up with all that and managing it, two or three homicides in, you're going to be overwhelmed. You're not going to remember the details from the first homicide if you don't take good notes. You're not going to remember when certain things took place, when you submitted certain evidence. So what you find is case file work is the quickest thing that'll run people out, because if it's not documented, everything you did is a waste of time. If it isn't put in a report or documented on a video or an audio tape interview or something like that, then you've just wasted your time and the police, you know, your supervision's time going out and doing everything that they've done. And we have had investigators that they're great out there on the street and they're great engaging with people. But when it's time to focus and get to the desk and start typing it all out, they don't have the patience nor the time to just focus. And they want to get out, listen to the radio, and jump on all these other calls. And that's when you can kind of tell when somebody's got really cut out for homicide or they just want the excitement of the job. Because the detective wants the excitement of the job. Doesn't matter if it's a homicide or a burglary or a robbery. They want to go out there and they want to get right in the middle of all the excitement. Mm-hmm. And that's great. It's good to have those kind of folks. You need those people in a police department. But in homicide, you want folks that are focused, that are linear, that can pay attention to what's happening and stay in the game, keep their head in the game for an extended period of time. Some interviews go at 30 minutes, an hour. We've had folks in a box for like 8 hours. That requires some intense focus, you know, constantly revisiting what you've already said, constantly going over the differences in statements. It requires you to be, you know, sharp. It requires the person helping you, the detective that's watching everything, to be sharp. And all of that's happening, and other things are happening while that's happening. So you might be in a box with somebody interviewing them, and you might have somebody at the house searching. So what's happening as you're interviewing this person, you're sending messages back to the person at the house trying to corroborate everything that they're telling you. So it's all happening simultaneously. And if something doesn't match up right at the house while they're searching the house, while the lead detective's interviewing, you can send a text and the lead detective starts to ask questions about that. Well, tell me about this. How come this was like that? The teamwork is important. It's vital to help steer interviews. It's vital to help figure out what evidence to process. Example, you get to a car or a house, you could throw fingerprint powder on everything. But and that would take all day, all night. I mean, I'm not a forensics detective. It could take forever to do that kind of thing. But if I was to talk to a suspect or a victim and they say specifically, I touched this, I grabbed that, I opened this, well, now you can go focus on the door, focus on the handle, focus on that, so you can really expedite processing of a house or evidence or those kinds of things. You can steer an investigation and narrow in on very specific things versus, you know, when we go out there, it's, we want to cast the net. But, you know, and try to get as much as we can. But once you start getting into the meat of it all, you got to start sifting what's irrelevant and focusing on just the pieces that matter.
And that concludes part one of our interview with Sergeant Hiram Pete Rivera. He, the homicide detective of the Savannah-Chatham Metropolitan Police Department. We thank him for joining us. We hope you'll tune in next week for part two. Part one was recorded from the lobby of the Marshall House Hotel here in Savannah. Our producer today has been Frank Pimbleton. And as always, if you have any complaints about this show, up to and including the sound of my voice, but not Sergeant Rivera's, send those to Frank. He'd love to hear from you. Any good things you have to say about this show or about life in general and how good it's treating you, please send those to me at sdeaton@georgiahistory.com. And if you have any ideas for future podcasts, we'd love to hear about those too. Our mailman this week, back from an enforced hiatus after that national championship game because he's a Bama fan, staggering in here under the load of mail we receive every week, is one Gary F. Taylor, born and raised. That's right. Our legal counsel this week and every week is provided by the law offices of Gallipo and Taylor, where their motto is, "We don't mind an honest day's work as long as somebody else does it." Our caterer this week and every week is Hagee's House of Tacos, home of the Drippy Enchilada. All beverages provided by our friends at the Drost Brewery, where their motto is beer, because that's what your right hand is for. Our engineer this week and every week is the hardest working engineer in show business, Brendan Cannonball Krellen. You can find out everything going on at the Georgia Historical Society by visiting our website at georgiahistory.com. You can find out about the Georgia History Festival that is just about to start at georgiahistoryfestival.org. And you can now find our podcast at Google Play if you have an Android and at the Apple iTunes Store and the podcast app if you have an iPhone. Please tell your friends and family about all this because, after all, misery loves company. And you can find my blog and other similarly painful podcasts at offthebeatenpath.georgiahistory.com, although I hope you didn't think this one was painful because of my friend Sergeant Rivera. I hope you'll tune in for part two next week. We'll see you again. Thanks for listening. So long, everybody.